Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite football podcast back for another week. My name's Jack Collins and I'll be your host today. And joining me on the microphone across the water, Mr. Dean Jones, live from San Diego. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, very good, mate. Look, you can see how American I've become. Look, sit here.
7-Eleven coffee.
A 7-Eleven coffee. I mean, does it get any more Americanized than that? I've converted. It was, those Costa days are obviously gone, mate. So all the visits
famous
to Costa,
I would make. Costa.
Yeah, Costa's gone. And there's a 7-Eleven right at the end of the street here. And yeah, I'm a convert to 7-Eleven coffees, which they've got a great policy as well of getting free coffees. So I'm basically like buy one, get one at the moment. So that's been good. I'm not spending too much on takeaway coffees, which is always nice when you consider some of the things that I am shelling out on at the moment here that are utterly, utterly ridiculous, like the $10 deodorant I'm not happy about. But there we go, Jack, you know, ups and downs, they'll be along the way. Might be $10 for a deodorant in some of the shops, but if you're getting a free coffee on the way there, it doesn't matter too much, does it?
Well, I suppose you're saving it in the aggregate, as they might say on Moneyball, when you put it all together in that kind of front. Today, we're going to be talking about some pre-season learnings. We're going to be talking about a few Premier League clubs who have high expectations going into the new season and what we learn from pre-season that might suggest whether or not they're going to live up to those expectations. So that's the main segment. But before we do that, let's bring back things we love, shall we, Dean? And what have you got for me this week?
Oh, mate, I'm just laughing, really, at West Ham and their transfer policy, because it never ceases to amaze me. They go through the same rigmarole every year, aiming for players that they're never going to get. I'm not sure they even want half of the time. Obviously, the one that jumped out at me this week was when they were in for Youssef Fofana all of a sudden. I mean, I'd barely heard any talk of West Ham really prioritising a midfielder in this window. But then obviously Kante was talked about and then Fofana was talked about. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on there. And then I'm like, okay, so what are we seeing so far from West Ham? They were suddenly in for Todibo out of nowhere. Didn't get him, we're never going to get him. Then there was the Kante. It's Fofana. There was Mazraoui. Mazraoui was never going to go and join West Ham. And then, as I'm talking right now, there's this ongoing story about them being in for Fulkrug as their striker that they would want. Now, I speak to someone at West Ham that I get a lot of my stories from, to be honest, and is very well versed in what they're looking for and usually has a good idea of whether the transfer targets out there are realistic or not, or whether it's fake news, whatever. The one thing he's been pretty sure of and pretty consistent on in terms of West Ham was that they wanted a reasonably young striker and it's got to have some level of Premier League experience. Now I'm like, right, Fulkrug. Fulkrug to get. That's exactly where West Ham are going to be shopping. So it's like, oh my goodness, like all these players that you've been linked with and you keep just veering off track and going for something random. I'm not saying that Fulkrug is necessarily a bad target for West Ham. I don't think it is, but he's 31. He's never played in the Premier League. So that doesn't fit. And you're supposed to be going for John Duran. And I'm not entirely convinced yet that they really want Fulkrug and they're not just trying to scare Aston Villa into being like, oh, forget Duran, we're just going to go and sign someone else. Because Duran, they really have put so much emphasis on, they just don't want to pay £40 million. And fair enough, I don't think I'd want to pay £40 million for John Duran either. But they really like him. So Aston Villa are obviously holding out for anything they can on that deal. So we'll see. Look, by the time this pod goes out, I think the Fulkrug story might have been shaping up one way or the other because contact is there. Yeah, I'm just a bit baffled by it all. But this is pure West Ham. They cast the net far and wide every single year and they'll have 10 targets in every position. And half the time, the ones that you really think, oh, that'll get me excited, there's just nothing to it, or there's just no chance of it happening. I mean, Taribo and Kante and Masraoui and Fofana, hell of a four to go for, right?
Yeah.
But none of it's come off. And you're at that point now with West Ham where the fan base are just fed up of it, I think. You know, they don't like being spoon-fed names they're never going to get. And they want the board and Tim Steiten to come up with something here that's proper and carefully thought through and is actually going to work. There's a distinct possibility that this Lopetegui appointment is going to become underwhelming quite quick if they don't get off to a good start to the season. You've pointed out quite quickly that he could be a foreign version of David Moyes. And that could well be the case. I've already seen quite a fair few West Ham fans moaning about their style of play in pre-season. But yeah. Something's got to give here. And the only reason it's a thing I love, I mean, this isn't being horrible to West Ham fans. It's just laughable sometimes when I see them taking an approach on players that they don't either seem to need or want or have any chance of actually getting.
I think it's interesting watching West Ham's strategy play out across the course of the summer, because obviously right at the beginning of the summer, they were, you know, quite heavily involved in terms of and linked with a lot of Brazilian players, right? And there was that whole thing coming out of Flamengo where they were linked with Fabrizio Bruno, and it looked like that was all going through and done deal, and then it fell through right at the last minute. They seemed to agree a deal. Not quite sure exactly why that collapsed, but it did. They bought Luis Guilherme, who obviously did come in. And when you kind of look at that, you're like, okay, so they're starting to change their strategy, right? They're looking further afield. They're starting to, as you say, cast that net a bit wider, not necessarily in the way that they had done in previous years, but actually starting to scout different places. And obviously Steiten seemed to be kind of at the heart of that change of strategy. And as the summer's progressed, it's just seemed to regress to the mean in terms of, you're like, oh, there's a player there on the market, whether they are a free agent or whether they are someone who's a little bit older and looking to come back or whatever that is. And look, the Kante deal for me, I was like, oh, probably quite a smart bit of business. If he's not having that much fun in Saudi Arabia, we know, and you spoke about the fact that he wanted to return to London rather than go anywhere else. That makes West Ham an appealing option. So when that link came through, I was like, okay, that's something you could probably consider. And at his age, you're still looking at a player that has the capability to make a difference, but potentially is too old to sign for one of the clubs challenging for, you know, right at the top of the table or in that kind of manner. So that link made sense to me. But where they've gone from there doesn't seem to make any sense at all. And this is the thing, is it comes to kind of recurring things. Obviously, everyone should have lots of targets, right? We're not suggesting that every deal goes off. You have to have a number of targets in each position. The thing with West Ham's, you know, the links that come back to West Ham quite regularly is that the targets don't make sense when you line them up next to each other. You talk about different types and different profiles of player. And yes, obviously you can adapt and make do depending on, you know, who comes in. But on the whole, I think you're kind of looking at this and thinking, well, you can't be setting up in one way and then suddenly pivot the entirety, you know, midway through preseason, completely pivot how you play in order to accommodate a different style of striker. And that's what it is. If you've got John Duran in there, who is a little bit of a chaotic footballer, who does like to sort of speed off into the corners, who isn't particularly positionally disciplined, that's one thing. Nicholas Fulkrug is a brilliant footballer and I love him very dearly, but he's nothing like John Duran. And so if those two are the links that West Ham currently have there, okay, if they sign both of them, then you're looking at a plan A and a plan B, fine. But if you're only looking at signing one of them, that's two very, very different styles of player that you're going to have to implement to get the best out of either of those players.
Yeah, well, the other one that's been thrown around a little bit in the last few days is Alexander Sorloth of Villarreal. So
good player. That's more like it. Like, that's more like a Duran-esque signing. That is not what a Nicholas Fulkrug does.
Exactly. So it's strange, but yeah, they've been digging around to see what the terms would be around Fulkrug, and I don't think moving particularly fast, because I think they're still hoping deep down that Villa think, oh, just let him have Duran for 33 million or something. We'll see whether that gives in the end.
Well, John Duran is apparently doing his best to do to get this move over the line. He's being investigated by Villa for apparently making an irons gesture on his Instagram Live last Friday. So we'll see how that one plays out. But I'm not sure that's how I'd be trying to force a move out of the club if I was John Duran. It's not quite the imagine what you'd be looking for in a player. But hey, here we are. Any dream will do, I suppose, at this point for John Duran. He just wants out of Villa. So we will see.
He really does.
Yeah, he really does. My thing I love is that the USWNT under Emma Hayes are the absolute business. Now, they might not win this Olympics because there are some very good sides involved in this Olympics. And also, you know, we have this Spain, all-conquering Spain side, who truly are sublime. But the difference from watching the USWNT at the last World Cup and watching them at this Olympics is so stark. And the dynamism and fluidity of this attacking line, the busyness of this midfield, the creativity sort of spilling out of Rose Lavelle and Lindsey Horan behind this just incredible trident that they've got up top of Sophia Smith, Mallory Swanson and Trinity Rodman. They've been a delight to watch, like an absolute delight. And I've been so impressed how quickly they just seem to have rediscovered that spark, that verve, that intensity of play that made them so feared across the game, you know, for so many years. And it's taken one appointment to be like, bang, right back at the top of it. And I'm going to keep this short and sweet because I spoke about the USWNT a lot on Monday's podcast on Patreon. And I think that, you know, if there's loads to get into there, if you want to dig into this a little bit more. But on the whole, I've just been so impressed with these performances. And obviously, the game against Zambia was impressive in its own right to score three goals in the first half, to not kick on in the second half, a little bit questionable in terms of how profligate they were, those chances not being taken. And you're going, right, this is a good Germany side up next, who have dismantled an opposition in their first game as well, a very good Australia side for that matter. And then you suddenly come into it and you're like, oh, okay, that performance against Germany was sublime. And yes, Germany are missing a few key players, notably Lena Oberdorf. But on the whole, I thought the way that the US handled that game, that the way that they were able to tuck in when they needed to and just try and let Germany come onto them and spring that counter with the pace that they've got down either side. I thought Sophia Smith was absolutely brilliant again. What a footballer. She's obscenely good. And from that sort of facilitation role in the first game to being, you know, the leading light in this one and scoring those two goals, they were so good. And I've had so much fun watching them at this Olympics so far. It's such a delight to see Emma Hayes start her career as USWNT manager in this kind of manner. We've had a lot of our patrons being like, just give her the double role, make her manage the men's team and the women's team, if that's possible at this point. And, you know, I think that considering where they were and the question marks around the USWNT going into this game, because they've always got target on their back going into this tournament. I think a lot of people were like, well, look, new manager, not that many games, still question marks over bits of this side. Can we get at them? The answer so far has been absolutely and resoundingly no, because they have been absolutely at it from the moment they kicked off in that first game. And I've just really, really enjoyed watching them.
Yeah. I think as this podcast goes out, they're actually playing, aren't they? Because they've got their next match.
They'll be playing the evening after this goes out, yeah.
Yeah, so depending on where you are, like keep an eye out on that result that's coming in from the US women's next game. But as I mentioned on Patreon the other day, I ended up in an English pub actually, but they had the US women's game on all the screens and it was packed in there. And they were basically all fans of the US women's national team. And they were very confident, but also very excited about what they were watching. You know, when they cheer, it's not like limbs. It's not like being at like a huge England match or whatever, where everyone's throwing beers around or whatever. But there's yelps of excitement is probably the best, and a lot of high fiving going on, and it was a really good vibe. It was a feel good factor. Obviously not quite as strong as what you'd get in terms of expectation with the basketball team, who are literally never losing a game by the looks of things as we record this. But yeah, it's fun to be out here and just see how much confidence and enjoyment people get out of watching that women's soccer team.
Shouts out to Emma Hayes, doing a wonderful job already. Very, very exciting times for the USW.
It's not the worst idea, you know, to get her in charge of the men's team.
Honestly, I've heard far worse suggestions over the course of this.
There have been, yeah.
There have been lots of worse suggestions than sticking Emma Hayes in charge. Absolutely. All right, talking about expectations, I think it's time we move on to our main segment. We'll be talking about learnings from pre-season after the break. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it's time to get into our main ranking. And it is a ranking this week. Last week, obviously, we rattled through a number of players. There was this kind of order to things, but we're back doing what we do best. Dean's got a couple. I've got a couple. We're gonna throw these at you, but they are going to be in an order. And we're going to order them based on where we feel teams are, based on their expectations of the fan base ahead of this season starting. And then looking at preseason and trying to evaluate where we think they are towards those expectations right now.
Yeah, basically. And look, I'm not going to beat around the bush here. I'm going to start at five with Chelsea because at the moment, I don't see any evidence to suggest that Chelsea are going to be breaking back into the Champions League spots, which obviously has to be the objective under Enzo Maresca as he gets his reign underway. Further than that, I would potentially throw out there that this team could be on the verge of having an even worse season. It's early days, so I'm obviously making early readings into what we're saying, but on and off the pitch, I think the preseason's been close to a disaster. There's talk of Osimhen at the moment, and a potential transfer. And if I was a Chelsea fan right now, I'd be absolutely praying that that is true, that something could come of that. Because to come off of last season into a new term, have changed management, have got rid of some other people behind the scenes too, to be potentially offloading players like Conor Gallagher, who live and breathe the club, and to be signing Kieran Dewsbury-Hall as your main signing, it ain't it, right? No, that's no offense to Kieran Dewsbury-Hall. He's not the level of signing that is going to catapult you into a new reading of what is possible next season. And when you're watching the early preseason games so far, it's terrible. It's dreadful. The performance against Celtic the other day was one of the worst preseason performances you could imagine. They've obviously been beaten 4-1. I don't necessarily care too much about what scorelines are in preseason.
Yeah, like, it's not the results here that are worrying, it's the performances.
It's the performances. And the main concern too is that, like, it's not even just that their performances aren't good enough. It's that they're trying to adapt to a new system here under Maresca, and they don't have a lot of time to do it. And so far, they can't do it. From what I understand, there is some concern from within about how quickly they can adapt to what Maresca is expecting of them. And I think that is a big concern, knowing that you've got Man City to come on the first day of the season, because Chelsea can't afford to have a slow start to this campaign. And while, you know, Celtic were further on in their preparations, Celtic are having a good preseason themselves, Celtic are a decent team. Chelsea shouldn't really be in a situation whereby they are looking this bad. I mean, we're seeing individual errors, but we're also seeing a structure that just isn't working. And as an example, Reece James, which people keep talking about, is playing more of an inverted role. So he's coming from his right back spot, stepping into the midfield. It's not what we typically are expecting to see from Reece James. We're seeing this marauding player down the flank, getting involved in the assists and stuff. Look, it might not be the worst idea not having him do that, considering his injury history. Maybe his hamstrings aren't cut out for that anymore. And I've spoken to people who say, look, Reece James is perfectly capable actually of playing that midfield role. But if he's going to step inside, he cannot be overrun or overwhelmed in the manner that he has been so far. And it's not, I'm not putting Reece James at fault here. It's the system. Like, Chelsea are in danger of being completely overwhelmed in terms of numbers in those areas in the centre and then down the flanks. So what you need to look at here is what Maresca's trying to do, right? And the style of play that will be implemented. So we'll start off looking, when we start the season, like a back four. But as soon as Reece James steps forward into the middle, then the other two midfielders that are alongside him, they start to change their roles too. And you'll see somebody step forward. You'll then, it'll basically become like a 3-2-4-1. Like that's...
Yeah, that's the right amount of numbers.
I'm just making sure I've gotten the right amount of numbers on of players on the pitch there. But yeah, when they start to move, like that's what you would start to see, a 3-2-4-1. But the concern is that the two get exposed because they're quite often so far left as an individual in the system and they haven't got a lot of time to try to turn this around before the Premier League starts. And I can't see Maresca changing his plans away from this. That might be the most worrying element of it all. Now, look, I understand he's trying to implement change in a philosophy here, right? And you, if you're going to do it, you kind of got to live or die by it. And I've seen people say, look, when Pep Guardiola came into Man City, it wasn't all free-flowing at the start. It took time for him to get going and to set it into play. And that's
fair. Always going to give him time because he's Pep Guardiola. That's
exactly
right.
Enzo Maresca ain't getting Pep Guardiola time to do this, right? Even with the best will in the world, Chelsea will not be able to show that much patience or time. Look, the way things are going right now, Maresca could be gone by Christmas. Like, genuinely, like, if this was to carry on in the pattern, the things I'm hearing, and I'm not going to go into the details of all of it right now because I think some of it's a little bit too harsh on Maresca and on the overall setup because they are so early still in pre-season and trying to implicate what they're trying to do. But there are worrying noises behind the scenes about whether this can work. And there's definitely concern over that. And Chelsea haven't got a lot of time to fix it. And Maresca, as I say, isn't the type of manager that's going to say, okay, fair enough, let's go back to try a different system. Let's just play a straight 4-3-3 and get on with that. He's not going to do it. Also, Cole Palmer, like whereabouts is he going to be playing? There's talk that he won't be out wide. He might become more central and all these sorts of things. Don't overcomplicate things. Don't overcomplicate things. Things are complicated enough at Chelsea right now with all the instability that's been in place, all the transfers that have been happening, this policy of signing so many youth players. You lack experience at every single level of the football club right now, whether it's footballers, whether it's management, whether it's sporting directors, whether it's owners. You're all inexperienced at what you're doing, right, in terms of compared to the people that you're up against. Give yourselves a chance by just creating a platform in the early weeks going into the season and make sure that you're still in contention for cups and for the top four. And if I was a Chelsea fan, I'd be worried. And I know Chelsea fans are worried. Like I know enough Chelsea fans that are looking at the situation and thinking, yeah, this isn't good. And the problem for the ownership too is that they'll all end up saying, we're trying to run it like we're an American team and we're not. That's not how English football works. You can't have this turnover of players, of staff, and have success. One of my mates texted me today, this is an absolute shambles. Maresca already seems like he's totally out of his depth. Doesn't help the type of players that are being recruited so quickly this season. People are going to be saying, why on earth did you even ditch Pochettino? At least he had the players on board and he was playing some decent football by the end of the season. And it's going to be the same old, same old, same old. So, yeah, Chelsea, I don't know what the expectations actually are, but it should be that you're back in the, you know, knocking on the door of Champions League football and competing for a cup. At the moment, from the early pre-season signs, it ain't good, mate.
No, I mean, look, there are some caveats, right? And I think they should probably be put into here in that we aren't going to sit here and say, oh, you know, this draw with Wrexham and loss to Celtic are going to define this Chelsea campaign, because they're not. The thing that I would probably say in terms of where they can look to change things is, well, the way that things are looking right now, and with Reece James moving into midfield there, it was Romeo Lavia alongside him. Chukwuemeka moved a bit further forward to play sort of alongside Nkunku, and then Mark Gue played up top. So that's the way it kind of looked when they did have the ball. They didn't have the ball for loads of this first half. So there is that to consider. But if that is Caicedo in there with Reece James and his ball willing ability and ability to get around, are those overloads where Reece James was getting overwhelmed? And I think anyone can see that. And maybe part of the worry is that if Celtic, yes, a bit further along in their preseason preparations and also play very, very well against Manchester City, but if Celtic and Wrexham are starting to exploit those gaps and those overloads, yeah, then teams in the Premier League who have had this experience and, you know, the best teams in the Premier League in particular will obviously be looking at that and thinking, well, there we are. That's where the opening is every single time. We're going to keep hitting down that flank because we know that they don't have the, you know, the manpower basically to cover those areas. So that's a major concern, because if Dyson Maeda, Rio Hatate and Kyogo Furuhashi are looking at that and thinking, yeah, that's very easy for me to pick apart, then you'd imagine that Erling Haaland and Kevin De Bruyne are going to be looking at that and going, yeah, thanks very much. Well, we will have a little bit of that. Thank you. It will get better when Caicedo's in there because he's a ball winning machine. And the fact is he can get around those areas. But if you're leaving him and Reece James in there, you're exposing them to a lot of bodies. And that's going to be a place where they just pick up cards on cards on cards. And Caicedo does that anyway. So you're then trying to work that out. How does Enzo fit back into this squad? Obviously, there are major question marks about the build-up of this and how he's going to be reintegrated into this squad after everything that's happened with Argentina. All of those questions still have to be answered. But you would imagine that when this is Caicedo and Enzo, or if this can be Caicedo and Enzo alongside Reece James in there, there's a little bit more to it in terms of how they are able to deal with these overloads and deal with this situation. So that is something that they should, you know, be aware of. My problem is that you know, Enzo Maresca said after the game, he was like, look, there were some real problems. We had too high a line when we didn't have any pressure on the ball, which is completely correct. He's spot on. But you need to sort that out fast. And that's off the ball stuff that, you know, you can drill. So by the time Chelsea come into this Inter game, which they have next, if they leave Lautaro with those kind of spaces, and look, well, he might still be on holiday. You kind of don't know exactly what it looks like, but they're going to get bullied. Like, you can't have a player with that kind of space. If they leave those spaces for Erling Haaland, he could have five on the opening weekend, right? Like, this is a terrifying idea that they can't find enough pressure on the ball to be able to play a high line, which is clearly what Maresca wants to do. He also said that, you know, when we're building up from the back, we are going to make mistakes. There are going to be errors. We are going to give away goals. We just need to minimize those risks, which is fair enough. But the problem is that we're not sure who's going to be in goal. Robert Sanchez was basically reinstalled over Petrovic because he's apparently better with his feet. I haven't seen any sort of semblance of that at any point. And now it looks like Philip Jorgensen might come in. That's going to be a problem as well, because Chelsea will then have five senior goalkeepers on the books and they're going to need to shift some of them on. And look, if Petrovic leaves, fine. And look, I think he's a great shot stopper. He's not a perfect goalkeeper, but I think he did really well in difficult circumstances last year and gave a sense of calm to this Chelsea side that they didn't have at the back before. So if they're going to have five keepers on the books, well, people are going to be like, well, I'm not paying full price, because you need to get two of them off your books this season. You need to get two of those players minimum out of the squad, especially with a couple coming through from the younger age groups as well, right? The likes of Eddie Beach and some of the players that are in those kind of spaces, Lucas Bergstrom. It's all very, very complicated. There's a lot of players here. There's a lot of people to come back in. There's a lot of reintegration to do. And right now, it just looks like everything is all over the place. This squad needs tidying up, and it needs tidying up really fast. And at that point, then maybe they can start to get a handle on what is being expected of them. But what's the point in, I don't know, someone like Andre Santos or Angelo Gabriel being in here and be like, right, okay, I'm going to go in here and absolutely, you know, learn this quite specific system to a T if I'm going to be shifted off on loan in January, in August. It's all quite hard to work out exactly where everyone is. And I think that's going to be a major problem as much as anything else.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Look, there's so much concern. I saw that even Gary Cahill came out the other day and was like, they need to add experience to the squad. However exciting it is to buy young players, you know, they can't settle quickly, and Chelsea lack that nous of being around and being understanding of what is coming up. He pointed out Thiago Silva and the impact that he had at Chelsea. You know, it's not age that matters necessarily if you still can keep yourself fit. It's the experience, and that is just lacking massively in every area of this football club.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we've gone very deep on Chelsea there. So
that's the end of the show.
To be honest, I think we probably could do a whole show on Chelsea's preseason. But for now, let's move onwards. And I want to move on to brighter things with Brighton.
Brighton things,
because Brighton looked really good under Fabian Hertzler. And again, pinch of salt, preseason, et cetera, but they've been on tour in Japan, where obviously they're in the middle of a season. So it's good testing grounds to be playing against these kind of sides. And they won 5-1 against Kashima Antlers and then 4-2 in a slightly tougher fixture against Tokyo Verde. And Brighton's depth chart looks pretty unbelievable right now, even with Pascal Gross heading to Borussia Dortmund. And just to pick up on a few things that Brighton have been doing, Yankuba Minte's come in, obviously, for a pretty high fee, and he's getting a lot of minutes. He's not gone to Brighton to play as a backup here. He's not been let go by Newcastle because they were like, oh, he's kind of ready for it. But I think his performances at Feyenoord last season suggested this was a player ready to come out in and make an impact. Newcastle needed to sell for PSR reasons, et cetera, and Brighton have snaffled him up. He has not gone in there to be a backup. But they have an embarrassment of riches on the wings, because obviously Mitoma has been excellent, has been the kind of poster boy of this Japanese tour, as you might expect. But he's been playing some really nice stuff. He captained the side in the first game, which I thought was a nice touch from Hertzler. But generally, those two looked so explosive and so ready. And you're already going, oh, that's a very good pairing. And then you go, hang on, what about Simon Adingra, who was absolutely exceptional last season? What about Kosi Adubiri, who's obviously left Arsenal to go to Brighton because he thinks he's got a better chance of forging a first-team pathway there? And he was really good too. Staked his claim off the bench, scored two brilliant goals after replacing Minta in that Kashima Antlers game. Jeremy Sarmiento's returned from that successful loan spell at Ipswich last year. Ibrahim Osman has come in, looks really bright and sharp. Some really nice link-up, I thought, between him and Danny Welbeck at times in these games. And then you've got Julio Enciso, who obviously is out at the Olympics at the moment, but he might end up playing more centrally. Not quite sure where Hertzler is going to deploy him. Facundo Buonanotte as well, a similar boat position-wise. He's been impressive too. So you're looking at these players and looking at all of the different options they have, and look, it looks a little bit weaker at the back. Not necessarily in a bad way. They've still got a couple of players to come back in. We expect Lewis Dunk and John-Paul Van Hecker to really kick on with that defensive partnership that looked really good at times last year. But at the moment, Carlos Baleba is doing a shift at a centre-back to try and cover for his absences, Dunk's absence in particular. But Baleba moves back into midfield. Yal Kules looked really good since he's come in the limited minutes he's got. Obviously, we're seeing different players step into different roles in order to step up here. But it really does look good from a Brighton perspective. And one thing I would just say in terms of keeping an eye on, and might be one for you and for our FPL listeners, is that Brighton are going to be different from set pieces this year. Set pieces already playing a massive, massive role in this Brighton preseason. It's something that Hertzler sort of talked about changing when he came in, about being a really important weapon for sides to be able to use in an attacking sense, but also something that he wants to work on defensively. And obviously with Pascal Gross leaving, the kind of who's going to take them has come up into the air. Well, Valentin Barco has been taking them. He's doing really, really well at left back, bombing forward, making a difference, but he's been taking set pieces and they're really driven and low. And Brighton look really dangerous when they get the ball into those areas already. So I think that's going to change this year, but something that Hertzler's really keen on. And from everything I've seen from Brighton so far, and it's been useful having these games in Japan because they're often on like 10 in the morning and you can then sit down and watch them when not much else is going on. Everything I've seen from Brighton so far looks really, really good. They've got a test against QPR when they come back from this tour. But from everything I've witnessed from their preseason, with a lot of big names yet to come back in and some pretty central figures in this Brighton side yet to return from obviously the Euros or kicking back off it, and Bart Verbruggen obviously coming back from being Netherlands number one over the course of these Euros, some big players to step back into the fold, and they already look like they're cooking on gas. So looks so far so good from a Brighton perspective.
Oh, mate, like what I've checked out so far of Brighton, their play looks so fluid, and some of the ways that he's setting the patterns of play are unbelievable. So we've talked about Maresca a minute ago and trying to implement his style to play and how Chelsea are struggling with it. And yet you look at what can be done and you're like, okay, so it is possible to kind of get your philosophy in there early. And to get the players on board with what's going on. And it's good that you point out Barco as somebody that's going to kind of be instrumental. You know, whether or not the set players end up sticking around and whether he stays on them long term, we'll have to see. But even if that's not the case, I think in FPL, Barco's a 4 million option. Like, he's the best 4 million option in the game, probably. He's going to be starting the season. And I think just in the way that he's been playing, like, the advancement you'll get from him in this side style of play will be a reason to consider him as a top asset at that price point. And if he is on set pieces as well, then it's just an absolute bonus. His deliveries are really good a lot of the time. It's obviously, if everybody else in the world is talking about these deliveries and the style of them, then you'll imagine these Premier League opponents are going to be well tuned into them, and how to defend them is the only concern. But yeah, even with Barco, you think back to last season, obviously made a couple of high profile errors. Well, look, he's learning on the job. He's young and he's playing in a position with a risk factor that does bring errors, but it's the bravery on the ball that is going to shine through for a player like that. And you have to have bravery on the ball to work in this Brighton team.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see what this season looks like under Hertzler. I thought his Sampdoria side were lots of fun last season. I think it's been interesting watching him. He played mostly with a 3-4-3 last year. There have been elements of that at times during this preseason, but he's also showed that kind of sense that he's going to use a four at the back in order to try and get the best maybe out of these fullbacks and the best out of the squad that he's got at his disposal. And that's something, right? It's a, you know, there is obviously something in coming in and implementing a style, which we can already see with this Brighton side, but it's also not, I'm stubborn enough to be like, I am going to play with this formation because this worked for me last time. It was coming in, assessing the options at his disposal and playing players in positions that are suiting them and getting the best out of them. And I think we've seen that from Hertzler so far. He's a young manager. He's going to be the youngest permanent manager ever in the Premier League once he kicks off that first game. It's very exciting times for Brighton right now. And I think after a good year last year, but not one that set pulses racing in terms of the Premier League. Obviously, they had a good spell in Europe, but in terms of their Premier League position, I think there was a little bit of a drop off. It feels like the fire has been lit under Brighton again, and I can see them back in that conversation for Europe, right, which I'm excited about seeing.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. Absolutely. Let's move on to the next one. I'm going to put Man United in at number three.
We might have got these two the wrong way around.
Yeah, possibly. But I don't know, you know. I think there's a good chance that we're getting something hugely improved from Man United this season. It's a new identity that's being built. New talent is coming in. The only problem is that they've got the same old injury problems with Yoro and Hoyland already limping out of action in pre-season when they were in LA. But just judging from that Arsenal game at the weekend, I thought United's style of play was a lot better. I thought they were the better team in the opening stages of that Arsenal game. They obviously ended up losing the actual game before winning the penalty shootout. Obviously, there was a penalty shootout after a game that didn't end in a draw.
Naturally.
Mm. Naturally. But nevertheless, United played well. And one of the big takeaways from their style of play was the use of the fullbacks. And it seems quite clear that Ten Hag is going to have them more advanced this season and working differently with the wide forwards. And I think that that's going to be really interesting in terms of how he manages to make all of that work. So first and foremost, United have to kind of figure out who those wide forwards are going to be and who we can actually trust. So I'm going to the Man United game against Betis on Wednesday night here in San Diego. So one of the things I'm going to be looking at closely is the likes of Rashford and Sancho and Antony, and seeing kind of what, as much what they're doing off the ball as what they're doing on it, to be honest. One of the things I should have addressed with Chelsea at the start when we were talking about them was that one of the reasons that players like Reece James are going to become exposed is because a lot of Chelsea's wide players don't necessarily show the defensive mindset that is needed to get back and cover and get back and work and make sure that those spaces don't exist to exploit. And that's one of the things that will be the problem for them. And with United, you'd like to believe that that work rate is going to be there among players like Sancho and Antony and Rashford because they've got so much to prove this season. I'm not convinced it will be, but they need it to be. Because particularly with Antony and Sancho, I don't know what the future will hold for them at the club. But Wan-Bissaka in particular, like he played in that game at the weekend and I was like, you know, I'm seeing a much happier version of Man United because of what he's being asked to do. And if we got to a situation where it was Luke Shaw on one side and say it ends up being Mazraoui on the right, then suddenly United do have another dimension to their play and a bit more trustworthiness too. So this is going to be interesting. Obviously, players like Taran Malacia, we can't depend on things like that. So let's forget about those guys for now. But United, they need to figure out who's going to be starting the season in these fullback roles, first and foremost. But if they get it right and if they can get a pattern of play set in early in the next couple of weeks, then it looks to me like Ten Hag is putting a lot of focus on how they direct play down the flanks and then open up spaces too for Hoyland or whoever's playing through the middle, Xerxes, to actually get on the end of chances. Hoyland took his goal brilliantly in the Arsenal game.
He did.
And I just think that there are promising early signs for United. Off the pitch too, I've spoken to a couple of the lads who were out here working with Man United on the tour, and they're like, look, this place feels so much lighter than it used to.
Like, freer.
It just feels like they've had a weight lifted.
Videos, all of it. It looks like, and look, I think part of this is obviously the addition of two new assistant coaches, one of them being obviously Ruud van Nistelrooy, who is, you know, gets that kind of, oh, okay, there's a legend back at the club. There's always that kind of lift, I think, when you get something like that happens. But just the whole group feels like it's got like, okay, last season, it feels like they've drawn a line in a way under last season that I don't think I've seen for United for a while. And that doesn't mean they're going to be brilliant. It doesn't mean they're going to challenge for the league. I don't think any of those things. But I think it feels like you're like, okay, they're going to come out here and they're going to be able to play, you know, at least at the very start of the season with that expression that was kind of missing for the last while. They still have big holes to address in this squad, I think. There's still lots of work to do. But generally, it just feels a lot more cohesive and a happier camp from on the surface. But if you're talking to people as well, then that kind of backs that up than it has been in a while.
Exactly. And if you did get to a point where you were looking at your lineup and it was consistent to some extent of having Onana in goal with Luke Shaw, Martinez, Yoro, and say Mazraoui in front of him. And then if you can get Ugarte in, which they're still trying to make a breakthrough with PSG on trying to get him as the defensive-minded midfield player alongside Kobbie Mainoo with Bruno Fernandes in front of him. If Rashford is kind of given the sense of freedom that he's hoping he's going to get this time around so that he can get back to the numbers that he was at 2 years ago, then that will help them. And Hoyland and Xerxes fighting for game time through the middle. And then out on the other flank, obviously Garnacho is going to be the one that we'll expect to see, but the possibilities of Sancho, I don't have any expectations of Antony, but also Amad Diallo, who is a player that this is his defining season at Man United. He has to make that breakthrough properly this season at United. And in pre-season, he's actually looked good too, Diallo. He's definitely looks hungry. And the way that Ten Hag's talking sounds like Diallo will get improved minutes, certainly leading into the season. We might even see him probably get some game time against Fulham in that opening game of the season. It wouldn't surprise me at all. So,
no, me neither.
There is a lot of reason for optimism here at Man United. Obviously, the fact that Yoro and Hoyland already injured isn't great, but they weren't bad injuries as it stands. It's just that they can't have that happening. Like that's a flaw of everything. I know it's half bad luck, but that's the one thing that would undermine all the good
until
things.
It starts happening all the time again, in which case it goes further than bad luck, right? That's the tricky bit, because yes, I think you can put those two injuries down to, you know, of course, but if that starts to become a common theme again, then suddenly that's not bad luck again. There's something in preparation there. There's something in what's going on. So it's just one to keep an eye on. I'm not putting anything at anyone's door just yet. Don't you worry.
I think Man United will win the league.
There we go. Well, it turned on a joke anyway. Hot take from Dean Jones. Right, shall we move on? And two, I've got Spurs, who have had a really good preseason. They won 5-1 against Hearts. They won 2-0 against QPR and 3-2 against Vissel Kobe. They've looked really good in spells this preseason. Not all the time, but a lot of the time, Spurs have looked very, very impressive. They're playing with a really nice fluidity. And just like we were saying before, I think it suggests that players are really starting to settle into this Ange Postecoglou system, understand what he wants from them in every single sense, and really start to kind of dial into the style of football, but also the kind of way that Ange wants them to play. And someone I just wanted to talk about a little bit who hasn't been talked about loads. There's been obviously a lot of chat about Archie Gray. There's been a lot of chat about Bergvall, and all completely rightly so, because lots of that's been very, very good. There's been a lot of chat about Maddison, who's finally back and looking like he can be that string puller for this Spurs side. But I want to talk about Dejan Kulusevski, because I'm really interested in how he's being utilised. So against Hearts, he started in a midfield three alongside Maddison as kind of joint tens, 8-10 sort of thing. And then he replaced Bergvall in the second game against QPR after he went off with that minor injury. Thankfully for Spurs fans, that one has already been paid. He came back on in the Vissel Kobe game, so clearly that injury isn't a particularly significant one. But then Kulusevski started the third game against Vissel Kobe in the number nine role. Now, he played there in the final game of last season against Sheffield United, and he scored twice and looked really lively in there. And interestingly with that, I thought there were elements of what Ange asked Kyogo Furuhashi to do at Celtic in what he was asking Kulusevski to do in this game against Sheffield United. And there was more of that in this game against Vissel Kobe. He did really well. There's been some lovely link-up play with him in the middle. He's able to dovetail with the players around him. It was Son on his left and Brennan Johnson on his right in this game. The way that the three of them can switch around, that they can mix it up, that different players can go into different areas, the fluidity of that front three is really, really impressive. But I really like that Kulusevski, because I don't think he's a traditional Ange Postecoglou winger. I don't think when he's wide, he gives Ange exactly what he's looking for from someone down the flanks. But I do think he's quite a nice fit for what Ange wants as a number nine. And I also think that when we saw him playing a little bit further back alongside Maddison, and you don't imagine that Spurs would only utilize something like that in games where they felt very, very comfortable in their dominance of the ball. But that ability to link play in those areas and to create those kind of cute little interchanges, really nice one with Maddison against Hearts that set up a goal, and they put through a lovely ball as well for Bissouma to score in the game against QPR. What we're seeing from him in these kind of areas and those pockets that he's picking up are really, really interesting, despite the fact that he's playing in two quite separate and quite different positions. So one to keep an eye on this year, how Kulusevski is being utilised. And if Spurs don't go out and sign a big name striker, which I think remains still on the cards, I think there's a lot of kind of what ifs and who goes before they make any big money moves. And we talked about Ivan Toney there, but you know, unless Richarlison leaves, I'm not sure that Spurs are going to have the funding or free funding to line that kind of deal up. When all of that's put in case, you start to think, wow, if he's playing like this, could Kulusevski be used as the number nine through this season? And I'm starting to think that it's a viable option. But he's someone that Ange just trusted. I think he played 31 of the 38 games last season for Spurs. He's someone that's been utilised in different roles in his team. And finally, I feel like Kulusevski's starting to find a place here and a role, even if it's being used in separate positions, where he can influence and impact this team, and that creativity is being re-unlocked from where it was perhaps under Conte in that first season.
Yeah, I have to say as well, on top of that, I was quite excited for Spurs in the sense of tracking Chiesa's availability, because I mean obviously he's a player that would link up well with Kulusevski anyway, but additionally the versatility of Chiesa I think is something that'd be ideal for that team. Now I actually had it played up to me last week, the transfer and the prospect of it. Chiesa's been offered all around the Premier League in terms of finding him a pathway away from Juve, where he's failed to agree terms so far on a new contract. And Tottenham, I was told, had a little bit of a nibble on that and were like, yeah, we could be interested in that. And I think when you consider what they'd have to pay for Eze or or Neto or a player like that to add to their front line. Chiesa's cheaper and actually might be a really good fit in terms of any time one of their rotators falls out of, you know, either injury or form, whatever it might be. I think he would be a really good pick. So, yeah, just on top of that, I think that they have definitely got a good focus of what they want here. There's clearly a layered structure to what they're doing transfer-wise. They're focusing on this young talent, make sure that they're well stacked for future years. But it's that elite level of recruitment that now needs to step up. They need to get... They want three signings in from here to the end of the transfer window. And those three are all supposed to be like first team players, knocking on the door for a first team place. And that, for me, is what will define whether Tottenham can truly break through the ceiling and give Ange the chance to make his mark at Tottenham and become the legend that fans want him to become.
Yeah, absolutely. The early signs look good is basically, I think, where I'm at on Tottenham. And having seen some of the combinations, you know what? I'd put them in a similar boat to this Brighton side. The performances, as much of the results, have been really, really impressive. And the fact that we've seen Archie Gray playing at centre-back early doors to kind of add another string to that bow, do I think he's going to be utilised there in the season? Probably not. But I think him being kind of forced to learn a new position under this Postecoglou system probably gives him quite a nice grounding in what Ange would want him to do in terms of as a right back. I think it gives him a nice grounding in terms of what he wants to do if he was playing as a number six. All of that puts Archie Gray in a really good position, I think, to make an impact. I think Bergvall's done very, very well as well. Someone who's obviously been there for a little while to get his feet under the table, but it feels like he's going to have an impact this season as well. Whilst I agree with you, I think they need 2-3 more players if they're really going to challenge hard for those Champions League spots this year. I'm excited to see where this Spurs side is going because there's a lot about it that I really, really like. And I think that there's a lot moving in the right direction as well.
Yeah, there's one thing, Jack, that's going to ruin Tottenham's season. And that's what we're going to talk about at number one to close this section. Because Arsenal are super strength, super sized for the new campaign. I like what we're seeing from Arsenal. I like that they're not going a million miles away from the slow build-up that they've had over the last 2 years, which hasn't been like dramatic changes on the pitch or behind the scenes, but has seen a dramatic rise in their status and the possibilities for that team. Let's start defensively with them, right? Calafiori is now through the door. And having Yuri and Timber as well back in the rotation means that they now have like such resilience within the ranks in terms of their defensive options. And more than that, they're both like such smart footballers and they're both quite versatile across the back line too, which you can tell already that Arteta loves about having them involved. So the other day, Timber actually ended up playing centre back and Ben White was still at right back. And I think naturally you would have expected that to be the other way round once you had that availability. But you listen to what Arteta's saying and he's like pretty cautious to go too far away from what was successful for them last season. And Ben White was obviously one of the most consistent formers in the league. So he doesn't really want to take him away from that role. But he also wants to start building combinations around the pitch and playing players next to each other that need to start building bonds. And so I think we'll see a bit more of that. Obviously, Saliba and Gabriel are going to come in as the first choice centre-back pairing, but they're going to need backing up throughout the season. And Calafiori also coming into the equation now. We're expecting to see him mainly at left-back, probably see him become an inverted left-back. But he also has the capability to play at centre-back. And this is going to be part of the learnings of Arsenal and the development of Arsenal is being able to play different combinations. Also, having Ben White at right-back, it probably helps that he's got an understanding with Saka down that side and Odegaard when he drifts over. And I think that you probably want to you want Timber to start seeing that close up before you start just throwing him out there. Throughout the season, I'm sure that will start to change. You start to look forward in the pitch and you're like, okay, Calafiori is through the door. What's next? And Mikel Merino seems to be the player that they're homing in on. We've talked a lot throughout the summer about the types of players that Arsenal have profiled, considered going for, haven't gone for any of them, waited for the market to settle. And now that they are more settled and the market is more settled, they're trying to look for good value, but also good fits. And I think that Merino is certainly a player that is suitable for this style of play. That will have a knock-on effect too on what Declan Rice does this season. I spoke to somebody the other day knows Rice well, and he said, look, he's actually expecting to play a mixture of number six and number eight this season. It's going to depend on who that extra midfield signing ends up being. But if it is Marino, you mix him up with the sort of profile of other midfielders they've got in there already. Deck's kind of expecting that it depends who he's partnered with, but he'll be playing six sometimes, but also be let off the leash a little bit more as well. So that will be interesting, and I think that will improve Arsenal. But you look at the front line as well, and that is now becoming even stronger. And perhaps this is the bit that takes them even closer to the edge of actually being able to win the league, mate, because obviously we've seen that they were free scoring throughout last season, and some of the interplay was exceptional. But now you've got Gabby Jesus coming in, and Arteta said the other day that you can see a sparkle in his eyes again, and that he feels like he's got a point to prove. Jesus scored in the win over Man United, and he looked sharp. And Jesus has kind of become the forgotten man of that Arsenal attack at the moment. You're kind of just having him as like a has-been almost, and he shouldn't be a has-been at this stage of his career. He should have plenty to offer. And if he can continue this form through pre-season into the new campaign, I think he might even be pushing for a starting role. You've then got Ethan Nwaneri, who's obviously extremely young, but he could be that kind of surprise option. There's not really any room anymore for an Nketiah or players like that at Arsenal, but Nwaneri is a bit different. And I like the surprise factor and the bench factor that he could bring in this campaign. I think
really
that it's all
how strong he is. Like, he's quite diminutive, but he's incredibly difficult to knock off the ball. And he has that kind of ability to look up and make things happen because he's confident in his own physical strength. It's one of those weird ones where we were talking about Mikey Moore about this on Monday as well, similar vibe, but he's almost too young to go on loan. You don't really want to send a 16, 17 year out on loan because of where they are in their career. You kind of want them learning, but too good not to be getting minutes somewhere. So it's intriguing to see how Arsenal manage this. But I think you're right. I think he's probably someone that does get significant minutes off the bench this season. I'm just not quite sure in what position.
Yeah, exactly that. Obviously, they've let Smith Rowe go. And that, again, I think just shows that the strength that they have now in depth, the fact that Smith Rowe is deemed surplus to requirements, it's quite astonishing, really. That shows how far Arsenal have come in the course of 2 years. I've had to put them at number one because I don't think that the so-called failures so far of failing to win the Premier League are going to deter them from the task of finally getting there.
Yeah, I also don't think they're failures, but it is what it is.
It's what it's dressed up as, isn't it, every time they fall short?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's how I would kind of phrase it, but it's one of those weird ones where I actually think that Calafiori and the addition there will really help Gabriel Martinelli as well. I had a tricky season last year. Obviously, Trossard came in and kind of wrested that spot off him. There were injuries. There were all sorts of things going on. But I think he's been quite hindered by the fact that he hasn't had a left back that's going to go round him and go outside him at times. Bring Calafiori in, I do think, kind of helps fix that, because whilst he was brilliant as a centre back last year, and I did have my reservations about where he fitted in to this Arsenal side, I think when you watch what he was doing at left back, and we saw a bit of that at Basel, obviously saw at Roma before that, that ability to get outside and go round the player, which we saw even at the Euros when he was playing on the left side of a three for this Italy side, means that there should be someone taking players away from Martinelli. And if those two can strike up an understanding, and obviously we saw Martinelli score an excellent goal, the winner in the game against Manchester United, if he can get someone who's going to open up channels for him to exploit, we know how dangerous Gabriel Martinelli can be. I feel like he might have a big season as well. Someone that's going to, if they can get that relationship right, I really do think that Martinelli's explosivity off that left-hand side coming inside onto his right foot could be a really important weapon for Arsenal this year. And that he might well be, last year will be looked back at as a blip on a very, very impressively rising career.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's I honestly think it's a really exciting time to continue to be an Arsenal fan, and that of course you feel a little bit like shortchanged in the fact that you had such good moments and it just all fell flat on the final day. But you had that good run in the Champions League. You have pushed City to the limit. You couldn't have come any closer, really, than you actually managed in the end. The simple factor is, if you'd have won at the Etihad, you'd have won the league. But on the day when you took that draw, it felt like the right thing to do rather than go all guns out. So you can't even fault that effort, really.
Arsenal have been knocking on the door. At some point, someone's going to open it. At some point, Absolutely. Someone's going to open it. As long as they keep knocking, as long as they don't fall away, someone will eventually open that door. It's going to be interesting. I don't know if it's this year or next year, but it does feel like they're getting closer and closer to what they're trying to achieve here. And yeah, I think it's an exciting time to be an Arsenal fan. And with that, we'll probably call this main section to a close. We'll be back after the break with the latest from Dean's travels in America. Welcome back to Ranks FC. Time for our third and final segment. Dean, what's been going on in your American life?
Oh, mate, I tell you what, I got some good wisdom for you all back there in the UK this week.
Guru wisdom, guru wisdom, guru wisdom.
Now, Jack, you don't drive, so this doesn't really appeal to you, right?
But born to be driven, mate.
Yeah, personal chauffeur over there. But you're a car owner. You know, one of the frustrating things is when your car gets dirty. And nobody really wants a dirty car. It's embarrassing. It also means the car doesn't look as good. So if you've got a nice motor, you want to kind of keep it in good shape. But car washes, car cleans, however you get it done, whether you're driving through one or whether you're going to get it hand, they're not cheap. They're not cheap. And you've got to decide how often you're going to go and do that. And typically you kind of end up, if you were anything like me, living in England, mainly doing it a few times in the summer, basically ignoring it for most of the rest of the year. Now, out here, it's different because I've stumbled upon the greatest membership of all time. I've got a season ticket at a car wash.
Mate, it's gone from a season ticket at Craven Cottage to one at the car wash. That's a downgrade, whether you like it or not, as a downgrade.
It's not, mate. It's an upgrade. $25 a month at Superstar Car Wash. It is unreal. Unlimited car washes for $25 a month. It's unbelievable. You go through, read your number plate, and then you drive in to like a conveyor belt of cars that are waiting to go through. And you go through and there's a lady standing there who sprayed all the car down initially. I've only been through it. Well, I've done it through it twice so far. So she puts the soap or whatever on first. Then you start to go on the conveyor belt and you go through and all the washers start to come down. And all the old, same as a regular car wash, but just a lot longer, basically. And then you go through all of that. The car's looking nice and sparkly. And then you come out and there's just like, I want to say like 50 booths. And you come out and you drive into one of the like little car cleaning portals, right? And everything's there. They've got like the fiercest vacuum you've ever seen in your life. They've got all the different types of cloth you might want. They've got all these different things to just clean the part of the car that you want to scrub it up. And there's different tiers of membership too. So I think it starts even at $15 a month, mate. By the way, I'm going on here, I'd get these to sponsor the show. But honestly, of all the things I've found so far that the UK doesn't have that America does, a car wash season ticket is up there, mate. It's right up there. We're loving it. Every Sunday we're going to go there. We've already decided it's part of the day. And the boys absolutely loved it.
That was going to be my next question. Do the boys like it? Because there's some kids love car washes and some think they're really scary.
I remember the first time we went through a car wash and they both screamed and cried because they thought they were like monsters coming through the screens or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I remember those days as a kid too. You're worried that, you know, the window's all definitely shut and all that kind of thing. But they're at an age now where they're at 6 and 4, they both love that part. But then more than that, they love the after part where they both go and get their towels and like we give them a wheel to do each, like get that bit. Oh, there's a little mark there. You get that bit off. Then they go inside and they have to clean up like, because obviously they both kick the car seats, which is one of the most annoying things in the world, and they're all scuffed up. It's a brand new car, so got to keep it in good shape for as long as we can. And they're doing a proper job on it. They don't really have chores because they're both, one, lazy, and two, I know they wouldn't do a good job. So this is their first proper chore, and it's not a very difficult one, to be honest. It's quite an enjoyable one. Yeah, it's been very good, Jack. So my guru wisdom is actually just to anyone who's looking to start a business in the UK, it's like, go and set yourself up a car wash business that does unlimited car washes, because it's amazing. And there are so many cars in the queue, and it's gone instantly. Like, there's no waiting around. Different class.
Amazed, mate. Mate, I know only one membership that seems to have better value than this, and that's the £5 a month Patreon option on Ranks FC, where you get two extra podcasts, maybe three extra podcasts a week. That's the this is the equivalent for cars of the Ranks FC Patreon membership, basically.
That is all you. If you live in America right now and you're like, what two things could make my life better? I'd say a Patreon membership for Ranks FC and an unlimited car wash pass. There's more than just Superstar Car Wash. There are other brands out there.
Other brands are available.
But for, $30 a month or whatever, you could change your life and you'll be so happy. You could sit in the car wash, listen to a podcast.
I was just about to say, you can just sit in there and dial into that as well. So everyone's a winner by the sounds of it. And on that bombshell, I think it's probably time we call this a day. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to a clean car, Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much as ever for listening. We really appreciate you all, and we will see you very shortly, gang. Take it easy. Peace.